This program, brought to you by PersonalLifeMedia.com, is suitable for mature audiences only and may contain explicit sexual information.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to A Taste of Sex, guest interviews. This is Beth Crittenden, your host here at One Taste Urban Retreat Center in San Francisco. Today we are presenting on Personal Life Media, Dr. Charles Moser. He's going to be discussing his research and his background with unusual sexual interests and SM. So here at One Taste, we have a practice called orgasmic meditation. So that's our specific flavor of research, and we have about 50 people who live together in intentional community and run the retreat center and research intimacy and sensual communication in its various forms. One part of One Taste is a program that we call Urban Monk, which is a residential sensual immersion program that's actually hosting the lecture series that brought Dr. Moser here with us tonight. So he's getting ready to present at One Taste in a while here, and we're looking forward to it. Today on A Taste of Sex, guest interviews, join us as Dr. Charles Moser discusses his private practice in internal medicine and sexual medicine in San Francisco. Hear what some of the usual questions are as people are exploring their sexuality and their sensuality. And also hear about what makes people tick around sex, particularly when it comes to unusual sexual interests and SM. Dr. Moser, welcome again, and let's go ahead and get started. You have a private practice in internal medicine and sexual medicine in San Francisco. You are the professor and chair of the Department of Sexual Medicine at the Institute for Advanced Study of Human Sexuality. I love it. And you've also been widely published in such journals as the Journal of Psychology and Human Sexuality, Sexuality, Reproduction, and Menopause, and you wrote the book Sexual Disasters and How to Survive Them.
I did.
How do you fit all of this in a day?
That's a very good question. I sometimes wonder how I do fit it in a day. But it all seems to flow, and they're fun projects.
What led you into sex?
I was always a horny teenager. But I was also a horny teenager who went to the library a lot. And when people had questions, I looked them up. And so then when people were talking in, you know, around the school, I had a different sort of answer than most other people. And so people started coming to me with questions, which led me back to the library, which led me to research more and more. And I found it fascinating.
What were some of the earliest references that you respected? Like, what really got you on the path?
Well, I remember very clearly I was in the fifth grade, and this the guys were sitting around, and someone mentioned that one of our classmates had her first period. And the only thing I knew about periods were they occurred at the end of sentences. And I had no idea what was going on. And when I didn't know, people sort of made fun, so I had to go find out. And then I found out about periods and many other physiologic events, and that led me to talk to other people about what I was doing.
And when did you get kind of actively engaged with having partners? Like, when did your research get hands-on?
Oh, that's a good question. It depends what you mean by hands-on.
Uh-huh.
I was a normal guy who was looking to find partners, junior high school, maybe even public school. And then slowly we began looking for first base, second base, third base. But I was always interested in exploring and finding out what other people were doing, even if I didn't want to do it myself.
And how has it been to combine kind of traditional Western medicine with the study of sexuality?
it seems really natural to me. It's never really been an issue. And I have to say, I've only received support from people in medical schools and the hospitals I work. Everyone seems to be very accepting.
And has your practice always been the unusual sexual aspect flavor, or did you go more kind of mainstream for a while?
Well, you always have to, when you're a student, you always have to have the mainstream aspect to it. But no, I think I've always been much more interested in the extremes than in the center.
And how do you define the extremes?
It's the things that get other people upset and nervous.
Such as?
Well, I do a lot of work in SM, and that's obviously one of them. But I also work with sex offenders and people who have unusual interests, foot fetishes, hand fetishes, people who are interested in cross-dressing, in changing genders.
And when you say you work with them, is it that you start working with people psychologically, or is it a physical practice? How do you interact?
Well, I started out getting my bachelor's degree in physics, minors in math, chemistry, and biology. I then went to the University of Washington, got a master's degree in social work, which is my license to talk to people. And then I went on and got a PhD in human sexuality and opened practice as a sex therapist. I did that for a long time when I got antsy and decided to go to medical school. And then I went back and, instead of becoming a psychiatrist and doing what I did before and write prescriptions, I learned a new trade and decided to do internal medicine.
And you said before, when we were talking before the show, that you have a reputation for people being able to tell you anything without your getting judgmental. Is that the social work background or the personal history? What has you be so open?
I think it's just a good mix of a lot of that. Good practice says that you leave your judgments outside the exam room and you try and help the person with where they're at.
And I imagine that, well, tell me if I'm wrong, but it seems like a lot of people might come to you thinking that they have some sort of a problem that may just be a viewpoint. How often do you see that it's just an opinion kind of getting in the way of their getting off?
Often. It's unfortunately too common. We all live in a society which is unfortunately sex negative. And after a while, people internalize those feelings, and it's hard to get people out of it.
Mm-hmm. And how do people find you? Have they been kind of suffering with what they consider a problem for years, or can someone really early on come and see you? How does that work?
You know, I get every sort. I get people who are referred to me from other physicians or therapists. I have people who sort of luck out and come in the door and say, oh, I didn't know you existed. I get lots of referrals from the different sexual minority communities. I'm just around.
How many patients do you usually see in a day?
Probably about 20 patients and sometimes another 10 in the hospital.
And what's the kind of breakdown of gender?
Oh, it's probably 50-50 at this point. And I would say it's about 70% is something related to sex, and the other 30% is just general internal medicine.
Mm-hmm. So what sorts of questions could people bring to you about sex that would be relevant to medical expertise?
Well, people often have questions about, I want to do X, how do I do it safely? And then I have questions about, I want to go from here to there, and I don't know how to get there, and I'm worried about it impacting my health or impacting my relationship or impacting my family. And then you, as part of the process, help them figure out how to get there and present whatever it is they want to present in a reasonable way to their family.
And do they like go home and have sex, try it out, and then come back to you? Do you do consultations like that?
Well, when I was a therapist, that's precisely what you do. You sort of give people what we call homework, and they go home and they do it, whatever it is, and they come back and they report, and you say, ah, on the basis of what happened, your next assignment is this.
And now what is it like?
Well, now I have a pretty much fairly internal medicine practice, so I see a lot of people who have unusual sexual interests, but they're seeing me because their blood pressure is high and their diabetes is out of control and various other medical problems.
Do you ever kind of get attached to people? Do people ever kind of get inside? And how do you handle the more emotional side of this? I know sex is incredibly emotionally charged for a lot of people.
Well, I obviously don't do sex with my patients. But, you know, there are some patients that I remember one woman said to me, you know, if you aren't my doctor, we'd be really good friends. And I think that, you know, there are people who I meet who I think might be good friends, but our professional relationship doesn't allow that. And there are other people who really want that distance, who don't ever want to see me as a friend or as a possible friend, don't want to see me in the community. They want to just know that I'm in my office waiting for them to call.
What percentage of people in your personal life are you kind of out to about the range of your interests and practice?
You know, I tend not to talk about what I do personally. I will say, if you want to know if I do it, you have to seduce me. and because I think what I don't like is for people being judged on their sexual behavior. And I see no reason to put out what I do so people can judge me on my sexual behavior.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, maybe I'm gay, maybe I'm straight, maybe I do dogs. It doesn't matter. You should deal with me as how I'm treating you, and not about what I do in my private sex life.
Mm. What has you have the ability to have such kind of a magnanimous viewpoint? What's your source of that openness?
You know, I guess I really don't know that. What I know is that it's always been like that for me, and that when I look at my own issues, and we all have issues, I question where they come from, and I try and get back to the science and say, is there a scientific basis for what I'm feeling? And if I'm asking people, you know, if people come in and they ask me, what about X? And I say, here's what we know about X from science. And maybe that's okay for you. And, you know, people say, I don't care what science says. I have these feelings. Well, that's okay. But understand that they're your feelings, and maybe you shouldn't be pushing them on other people.
What sources of information do you most respect now around sexual practices and sexual medicine? In terms of literature, websites, organizations, where do you think the good information is coming from?
I get it from the academic journals, medicine, sexology, psychology, sociology, anthropology.
And is there a lot of sexual research being done that just isn't that out in the mainstream yet?
More than I can read every month comes out.
Oh. Where does the funding for it come from?
In most cases, people do it because they're interested in finding the answer and they're not funded.
Wow, that's significant.
That's very significant.
Huh. Has there been a patient who has come to you where you've just absolutely drawn the line and have said, no, that thing that you want, I can't have you going out of here trying that? Has there been an absolute line in the sand?
Well, I mean, first of all, there's legal issues. I mean, if someone said, I'm going to go out of here and hang myself, I have a legal responsibility to report that I can't allow that to happen. If I am told that someone is sexually abusing or physically abusing a child, I have to report that. If someone is going to do something that is obviously going to be very physically damaging, then I get to tell them that you're being stupid and you're going to hurt yourself. And, but the issue is how I tell them and how we sort of work through that.
Gotcha. So you're saying grain of salt with everything.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, we're getting ready to pause for a break to support our sponsors here. This is Beth Crittenden hosting A Taste of Sex guest interviews with Dr. Charles Moser. Please join us again after the break on Personal Life Media as we return to talk about more unusual sexual interests, and we'll get a little deeper into SM in the second half of the show. Thank you.
Listen to A Taste of Sex, Erotic Poetry Reading, a companion program to Life in an Orgasm-Based Community. It's open mic night at One Taste San Francisco, a weekly audio program on personallifemedia.com.
Welcome back to A Taste of Sex Guest Interviews. I'm Beth Crittenden here on Personal Life Media from One Taste Urban Retreat Center with Dr. Charles Moser. Welcome back.
Thank you.
So let's get more into something that we were talking about before the show, which is your intense curiosity around why do people have certain unusual sexual interests? Why does one thing work for dude A and it just doesn't at all work for dude B? What have you found around that?
Well, actually, it's still a question that has no answer. And I often, there's actually several of my papers that start off with how we develop our specific sexual or erotic interests is a basic and unanswered question in sexology. So we don't know the reason, and only by looking at people and their interests are we able to maybe shed some light on how people get from point A to point B. You know, it's sort of interesting that a lot of people try and change their sexual behavior or the sexual behavior of others and are completely ineffective at doing that. And everybody's sexual behavior evolves, and it does change. And so trying to change it doesn't work, and there's no way we know to influence it, so it changes in a certain way, but it does change.
What's your experience with the effects of not exploring our sexual interests and cravings?
There is a price to be paid for both exploring and not exploring their sexual one's sexual interests. And sometimes it's to someone's advantage to explore it and to get into it, and sometimes not. And it's an individual choice. You know, people will often, let's say, go out, have a fling, whatever it is, SM, gay sex, whatever, have a great time, 83 orgasms, everything's wonderful, and then get scared and say, I'm not going to do that again. And they may spend years trying not to do that again. And then sometimes they die before they do it again. And sometimes they just say it's a charade and they change their life and they start exploring.
Why do you think pleasure is so confronting or threatening enough that someone would entirely shut it down that way?
Well, if you think about it, people have lots of goals. You know, I have a PhD, an MD, a master's degree. The only way you get that is by studying. And so there were probably a lot of times that I could have been out doing something sexual that I was, you know, back in my room studying for the next exam. And so am I sorry that I missed whatever those sexual experiences are? Well, maybe a little, but I also like my life now and I'm glad I did what I did. And life is a trade-off. You know, you can eat the ice cream and be fat, or you cannot eat the ice cream and be thin, and you have to decide whether you want the ice cream or being thin as is more important to you. Mm-hmm. And people make different choices at different times.
How do you define SM? What's the basic foundation of it?
Well, it's an eroticizing some power exchange is how the people who do SM explain it. And what I do mostly is I let people self-define. And I try and get people to discuss what it is about it that turns them on. And what you find is that it's, even though people say, oh yeah, what we do is SM and what he and she does is SM, when you actually spend some time, it has nothing to do, they're not similar at all, they're very different. You know, when I was first doing my research, I met these two women in separate situations, both of which were into SM, and both of which said they had never met another woman into SM. It's many years ago. And so I decided to have a dinner party for the two of them so that they could meet each other. And so, you know, they came over and I sort of introduced them and I went into the kitchen to sort of make dinner and let them chat. And maybe 5 minutes later, one of them is in the kitchen chatting with me. I was like, wait a minute, why are you with me? Why aren't you out there chatting with this woman? And she said something very telling. She says, well, you know, I'm really interested in all the psychological stuff, and I'm not very interested in any of the physical stuff. And she's interested in all this physical stuff and none of the psychological stuff, and we don't have anything in common. And so they spent, you know, so we had a nice dinner talking about how people are really different. And they both had come over thinking they were going to find someone who they could share their experiences as women and as being into SM that were just very different.
That's a really interesting point. How many people do you think keep it in the fantasy realm, and how many actually physically explore it?
Well, it depends what you mean by explore it. You know, if you're talking about the married couple where she says, you know, I really like it when he throws me down on the bed and has his way with me, you know, there's probably a lot of people who play with that on occasion. If you're talking about recognizing that what they're doing is SM and owning the identity and exploring it in some regular systemized way, probably 5 or 10% of the population.
Do you give people consultations on how to stay physically safe, mentally safe when they're undertaking these practices?
Sure. You know, a lot of people say, you know, this is really turning me on, but you know, I also want to be around for tomorrow, and they don't want to do things that are really going to get them into physical trouble or mental trouble for that matter. And so there's often a little a discussion of, can this be done safely? You know, what are my chances of being hurt here, contracting an STD, contracting a physical problem? And it's interesting because a lot of people are very concerned about it, but very few of my patients wind up seeing me because of an injury related to sex. I always tell people it's much more dangerous driving to and from the party than being at the party.
Good distinction. In terms of an SM gradient, what would you say would be a range of several different practices, starting from more vanilla on through to a little bit spicier across SM play?
There are people who, let's say, want to be play in the submissive role. And that may be very well defined. You know, I'm going to be submissive for the next, you know, 25 minutes, and then we're going to stop. Or it could be, I'm going to be submissive every time we're in bed, but not outside bed. I'm going to be submissive all the time that we're together alone, but never when there's someone else present. I'm going to be submissive all the time, but only at a very low level. Or all the way up to, I want to be a complete and total slave with, you know, all the time, and I want you to do with me as you please.
What makes really good SM, in your opinion?
When people really get off. And what really gets people off is really different. I mean, you know, it's sort of like saying to someone, that person is really good at sex. That's a meaningless statement. For some people, we'll take a he's too rough. And for some people, he's too gentle. For some people, he's going to be too big. And for some people, he's going to be too small. For some, he's going to be too fast. And for some people, too slow.
So then what are the important elements that you might suggest to people around being able to communicate what they need specifically so they can get off?
Well, that presumes something which is often not true, which is people know what they need to get off.
Good point.
And so I think what you have to do is you have to get people talking, and you have to get people experimenting and saying, all right, you didn't like it when I did A, let's try B this time. Or we did A, B, and C last night, and maybe A worked and B and C didn't. So how can we expand on A and go further? See if that will help.
Are there any practices that just leave you totally scratching your head? Like, I have no idea why that would turn someone on.
Oh, lots of things. I mean, there is nothing that hasn't been eroticized, You know. Do I really understand why people get off on rubbing people's earlobes? No, I really don't understand that. But I can tell you there are people who get off on it, and they really love it. And what's really interesting is trying to get them to talk about it and explain what it is that really turns them on and how, you know, whether they like the big earlobes or the little earlobes or the brown earlobes or whatever, and what's special about those earlobes for them.
Is there qualitative or quantitative research being done where people are physiologically tested for get-off? Is there a way we can measure that?
Not very well. There are people who are trying to look at that. The big research is in trying to see if we can change people who are sex offenders. You know, obviously, people who are abusing children are a menace to society. I mean, we have to protect children. And so if people are having sex, are in hospitals or prisons, and they've gone through a therapy program, we'd like to know if, in fact, we've changed their erotic arousal pattern. And there are some techniques to do that, but it's unclear how good they are, how predictive they are.
Are there sex acts that have been criminalized or marginalized that you feel strongly should not be?
If you're talking about globally, I mean, homosexuality is still illegal in probably more than half the world. And I think we have enough data now to say that it harms nobody and is a wonderful source of help for some people. SM is a similar issue. I do a lot of work in the as an expert witness, and I've never seen in a case where someone was involved in SM that got custody of a child in a divorce proceeding. That sounds pretty discriminatory to me. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm a scientist, so if you say something is sick and bad, where's your data? Show me the data. Let's see if, in fact, there's truth here. I don't care if that's how you feel and that's your religious upbringing and that's how you see the world. I care about science and data. If you have data, well, maybe there are some things we shouldn't be doing. But then I want to see the data.
So from the scientific viewpoint, what's the big deal about non-procreative sex?
I don't have a problem with non-procreative sex, and I'm not quite sure why, if any real scientist does. Most sex is non-procreative. If you just save sex for procreation, I almost want to say what a waste, because you can't procreate all the time.
And on the flip side of that, then what do you see as the value?
Of procreative sex?
None.
Of non-procreative sex. You know, it's a wonderful sleeping pill. It's a great way to bond with people. It sure is fun. It beats washing the dishes. I mean, it's hard for me to imagine why anyone doesn't like it.
So what do you see people usually needing to step through to get to kind of a healthy level of openness around sex? What are they usually wading through?
You know, different people wade through different things, and it's not clear how many of us really have open sex. I have on occasion taken people who said, oh, no, I'm really open and loose, and 5 minutes with me, and they decide, no, they're not so open and loose.
What do you say to them?
Well, you ask them what they like and why they like it and why they don't like other things. And, you know, Let's think about a simple example. If I would blindfold you, I don't know if you're gay or straight or bi or what you like, but if I would blindfold you and somebody would do oral sex on you so you couldn't see who it was, you would have a different reaction if you found out the person was male or female, and maybe if they were young or old, and maybe if they were ugly or pretty, or, you know, all these different things. And I say, what does it matter? You're still getting the same sensations, and why do you have to know?
That's cool. Has there ever been a time where you've just felt like you kind of hit a wall with this, that there's just too much repression, too much judgment, you couldn't do it anymore, it wasn't worth it?
Well, I surely hit walls, but it's never to the point where I can't do it. You know, I write my papers, and I give lectures, and I talk to people, and eventually people will remember me for being able to say, he understood it. He did good research.
What do you understand?
A little bit about the breadth and differences in sexual interests and how people express it.
And what's your message to people who are struggling to fully know that part of themselves?
Sex is fun. Enjoy it.
Thank you so much for being with us here today. Looking forward to your lecture.
Thank you.
So thank you for joining us tonight on A Taste of Sex guest interviews. This has been Beth Crittenden, your host from One Taste Urban Retreat Center on Personal Life Media. So pleased to have presented this discussion to you. If you'd like text and transcripts of this show, you can visit www.personallifemedia.com. If you'd like to send us an email about whether you love us or hate us, please email us at onetaste@personallifemedia.com. To learn more about One Taste and our programs, including Urban Monk, you can visit www.onetastesf.com. Thanks so much for joining us. Hope you got a lot out of this, and remember the message that sex is fun.
Find more great shows like this on personallifemedia.com.